the opportunity and environment for funding is super strong. So if you are a company that's looking for funding, you know, this is a pretty good time to be, you know, to be out there looking for capital. That's not a, it's not a guarantee that every company is going to be funded, but the amount of capital and the amount of players that are out there looking to deploy capital is at an all-time high.
And now from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is John Norris, a Managing Director for Business Development at Silicon Valley Bank. John spearheads strategic relationship with many healthcare venture capital firms and serial entrepreneurs. With over 20 years of banking experience, John frequently speaks at major investor and industry conferences about healthcare investments trends. In this episode, John gives us the rundown on how the pandemic has affected and will continue to affect investment in health technology and device startups. He covers cyclical funding patterns, which sector of healthcare are the most appetizing to investors, and why right now is the perfect time for startup to find capital. Here's our conversation. Well, welcome, John. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. So great to have you finally hear more about your thoughts on funding in the medtech and health tech space last year and actually this year as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We all know about your report. I mean, actually, so many people have referred me to your report for many, many years. And so I thought it would be good, first off, like, how many years have you been doing this report?
Yeah, so it's been for a while. I think we're trying to calculate it out. I think this is this last report that we came out with in January was our 10-year report. And so, you know, we've been doing this for quite some time, and it really came, you know, it's interesting. It was at the genesis of like around 2008, 2009, where we had, you know, the recession, and we had that huge dip in fundraising as well as investment into companies. And we're just trying to figure out, you know, where were things going to go from here? And I think, you know, really the first reason we sort of put this paper together is kind of a pre-reason, which was to figure out which venture firms did we think were going to continue to be, you know, able to raise funds in this really hard environment. And in order to do that, we were looking at what were the near-term exits that we saw, who were the investors, and which firms, which folks were on the board, just to try and get a sense of who had the attribution at that period of time. Because we thought near-term attribution was going to really be, you know, a significant factor for folks being able to fundraise again. And then that led to, you know, really looking at the financings that were going on and realizing that all the data that was out there was very much kind of focused on average. So there were, you know, 200 transactions and the average exit was 120 million. And it's like, well, what does that really even mean? It wasn't really differentiated between biopharma and device and health tech and DX tools. You couldn't tell what was upfront or what was all in deal structures, et cetera. So we really started to think about, you know, it would really be valuable not only to the folks that we engage with in my job, which is on the VC side, but just for the industry at large to have better set of numbers that could really give people a feel for what's going on in the industry. So that's kind of my very long answer to your short question. It's been about 10 years and it's really been a lot of fun.
No, I think you have gained, I mean, this 10 years you have gained so much traction and well, everybody always say like, oh, have you read John Norris' report? So you're really known in the industry for doing this. And it's also really helpful. And maybe give us a little bit of the background on how you gather all this data.
Yeah, also great question. And you know, putting this data all together it's also kind of selfish for me because as I said, you know, my job is sort of interacting with the venture community, and putting this together really gets me, you know, all the data at my fingertips, and it really sort of informs me. But it's interesting. We sort of, you know, when we look at the data, we put it into two different sort of groupings. You have the investment data, and then you have the exit data. On the investment data, you know, what we do is we leverage the underlying data is PitchBook data. And I think they do a good job of putting together the financings that are out there. But we look at every single financing through the PitchBook data, and then we recategorize it in what sector we think it is right. And then we do one step below that by saying, what's the lead indication that this company is focused on? So we'll look at the financing, we'll open up the website, we'll take a look at the company, and then we'll use our best efforts to really categorize them in a good way. And so that's really the financing data. That's when we look at all the deals of, you know, investment into companies. On the exit side, it's a little bit more of a, you know, combing through public data. So we're looking at, you know, obviously IPOs, we're looking at the press releases of those IPOs. We're really trying to look at the underlying financings of those deals. Yeah, we're leveraging the PitchBook data from those venture-backed companies that went IPO, who were the investors, what were the structures, what were the step-ups, et cetera. And then on the M&A side, I think, yeah, what's really intriguing about life sciences versus tech is that life sciences are more apt to actually tell you the deal structure of the M&A transactions. On the tech side, a lot of it is undisclosed. And when we've done this analysis, especially because we sort of cross over into looking at health tech deals, mm-hmm. the vast majority of health tech deals are undisclosed. And it's just...
Why
it's,
is that?
It's I'm not quite sure. I think it's more structural because, you know, more often than not, it's larger companies that are making those acquisitions. And they just don't... It doesn't move the needle in terms of reporting. So if they don't need to report it, they're not reporting it. Whereas... somehow in this life science community, we've gotten to the point where, you know, we've publicized these deals, even if they're not so significant that it's worth reporting for in terms of regulatory requirements. So that's been great. And then, you know, I'll also try and dig as much as I can for, you know, looking at deals that maybe aren't disclosed. And, you know, sometimes a quarter or two later, it'll appear in some sort of, you know, regulatory filing, or it'll appear somewhere else. So I really do a lot of digging and leverage my contacts to try and find my best case scenario of those undisclosed deals as well, to try and give as well-rounded a deal structure as possible. So those really are the two sources. So, you know, PitchBook data on the financings, and then just really getting into, you know, the streams of press releases, et cetera, to make sure I'm really looking at the exit environment as comprehensively as we can.
As you can tell, the health tech deal, there's a lot more these days. So you end up have to do a lot more digging based on what you're saying, because the information is not there.
It's really hard. Yes, it's been, and health tech's been really interesting now too, because, you know, not to get into the detail and answer a question you haven't asked yet, but, you know, you obviously have M&A activity, you have some IPO activity, then you see a lot of SPAC activity in health tech as well. So I think it's a very intriguing sector. It's getting a lot of investment, but also a lot of exit interest.
Yeah. So I thought maybe we should talk about the meat of the report a little bit more. And maybe going back in the early 2020, I think in the beginning of the pandemic, everybody was very concerned, like how investors going to continue investing new ideas and startup. It looks like things are moving forward despite the pandemic. We see records in number of funding.
Yeah, I think so. It was very intriguing, you know, when I look back at 2020, you know, obviously it was a terrible scenario with this pandemic and you know, a lot of things that were really scary for a lot of people and obviously, you know, heartbreaking in terms of folks who've lost their lives to COVID. And it was, you know, I kind of think back to March, and if I'm just, you know, putting aside the tragicness of the pandemic, which we're, you know, I feel like we're seeing light at the end of the tunnel now, which is fantastic. But putting that aside and looking, you know, looking just at the financing and the financing world of life science, in March, you know, my focus really was on interacting with the VCs to understand, you know, what does this mean? Because that was the time of the shutdown, right? And it was like, well, what is that going to mean for the industry? And I think the themes that I heard was very similar to what we heard in 2008 into 2009, which was, okay, I got to look at all my portfolio companies. I'm going to put a pause on investing into new companies. How is my portfolio going to do? How much cash does each of my portfolio companies have? What does that mean in terms of remaining months' cash? you know, if they have revenues, how would those revenues be impacted, especially for like med device companies, right? And how do I make sure that they have enough funding to get through this year into you know, Q2 of next year? That was the main type of feedback that I heard from venture folks. It was not looking to do new deals. So really when we started Q2, I was thinking, okay, you know, this is going to be really a proactive focus on portfolio and not about new investments for some considerable piece of time. But I was actually totally wrong about that. And what was interesting is into March, we already started to see some of this, you know, biopharma overflow of IPO companies start to go public, even in the face of this serious pandemic, and they were doing well. And I think that started to give people a little bit of confidence that the market was actually was okay. And so what we started to see was folks re-looking once they figured out that the portfolio was okay, really understanding, you know, I have a lot of capital to deploy. I need to look for new deals. And how do I do that in a pandemic arena? You know, can you do a deal virtually just by doing Zoom meetings? And I think, you know, the resounding answer in healthcare was yes. And I think the reason behind that was, one, you know, it's a pretty well-networked industry. It's obviously smaller than tech. A lot of people know each other. You can sort of do your due diligence on people with basically one phone call of somebody that you know has probably worked with that person in his for a significant amount of time. And so I think what we found was that, you know, it was almost business as usual with a little bit of an overhang of, you know, what's, you know, healthcare has become such an important topic for, you know, engaging in and dealing with the pandemic, where you had, you know, device companies, when you think about respiratory issues, you have the DX tools world in terms of tests. You obviously have biopharma relating to therapeutics and vaccines. And it's just, it was really interesting to see, you know, that the focus was not on being scared in terms of the industry, but the opportunity for healthcare to help. And I think that people saw that not only in the companies that were already around, but in the promise of investing in these startups. And so I think all those together, you know, really pushed, you know, investment into companies to a new record. It was amazing to see, with Q3 being actually the best quarter in terms of dollars being invested into companies in the US and Europe in healthcare that we've ever seen, at over $15 billion, until we saw Q1 of this year, which I will say, Q1, I just did my sort of pre-analysis, and, you know, numbers can change and things, you know, maybe these finances can get posted a little bit later and PitchBook picks it up later. But looking at Q1 of this year, another record has been set in investment at $22 billion. So $15 billion was the record in Q3 of this last year, 2020. Q1, $22 billion invested into healthcare companies in the US and Europe. So we're not slowing down at all.
So do you think it's because many of the ventures raised a new fund in the beginning of 2020 and that still carry on? Or do you see more ventures being created?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you're right in terms of the venture-backed, you know, funds or venture funds that have fundraised. I mean, you know, you have a lot of sources of capital coming into healthcare. And I think having these outside sources, which you could say, okay, the hedge fund players, the private equity folks, the family offices, the sovereign wealth folks, you know, all these are extra, you know, corporate venture, all this is extra capital, but you layer on top the venture folks. And I think what's important to know is on the venture side, you know, that is their sole thesis. You know, the other sources of capital can come and go, and it's not necessarily entirely earmarked for a very specific, you know, investment thesis, whereas venture capital is. And so the healthcare venture funds that raised over the last year, which has been substantial, a lot of capital, and their job is to deploy that capital into new companies. So we are flush with, you know, new record in terms of, you know, venture capital fundraising. Just in 2020, $16.8 billion was fundraised in that year, which was on top of the previous year's record of $10.7 billion. So that's $26 billion in capital that's going to be invested right. into new companies over the next 2 to 3 years. So there is a lot of capital. And I think that certainly has buoyed the investment pace and the amount of capital that's going in. But I also say, you know, you look on the other side of the equation, which are the exits. You know, the exits have been very strong as well. So, you know, a lot of times it's hard to get both of those two group, you know, the investment and exits to both be strong at the same time. But we're seeing that right now.
So do you think, you mentioned last year, there's like $26 billion of funding being raised. So that needs to be deployed in the next 2-3 years. So at least you think that the environment of a new investment for a startup will be pretty strong in the next couple of years.
I think it will be strong. I do. I think, you know, will it be as fast as the last cycle of fundraising and dollars investment? You know, if in January I was predicting maybe a little bit of a slowdown, but looking at the Q1 numbers, that did not happen whatsoever. So we'll see. I do. I think, you know, the opportunity and environment for funding is super strong. So if you are a company that's looking for funding, you know, this is a pretty good time to be, you know, to be out there looking for capital. Now, it's not a guarantee that every company is going to be funded, but the amount of capital and the amount of players that are out there looking to deploy capital is at an all-time high.
So do you think, I mean, if you see the stock market has been doing really well, to what extent do you think the government policy, the economy policy helps all this activity that trickled down to the startups funding?
Yeah. And I think, you know, government policy is hard to comment on, but I will say when you think about the environment where, you know, one of the things that people look to is the inflow and outflow of capital sort of into, you know, startup companies, you know, both tech and healthcare. And I think, you know, there's really not a lot of other places to put investment dollars right now because the yield is really low. And so, you know, it really just it's almost as if, you know, that there's, you know, until that market changes significantly, that, you know, healthcare as well as, you know, technology is a great place to look for yield because you're seeing great IPOs, you're seeing good performance after the IPO, and again, there's not a lot of alternatives. So I do think we have, you know, investment exits, you know, economic policy that sort of, you know, makes you know, these early stage, you know, technology and healthcare opportunities attractive. All those together, you know, it is sort of the perfect storm in a positive sense for innovation in the sector.
And it doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't. And I think, you know, the other question that gets asked a lot is whether, you know, do you think this is a bubble in which we're in acting right now? And yeah, you know, my perspective on that, at least from the healthcare side, I'll talk about healthcare because I'm not as savvy as tech on the tech side because I have colleagues that really focus on the tech side. But for healthcare on the venture side, I really think, you know, I'll say when you think about having a can of root beer and you pour it into a glass, you know, you see that fuzz, that froth that grows, but you still have the contents of the root beer itself, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the froth. And I think, yes, there's the it's not a bubble because when I think about healthcare, I don't think about sort of a pin hitting a bubble and just completely disintegrating. I do think it's frothy. And I think it's frothy from a valuation perspective. Mm-hmm. I think it's frothy from a valuation perspective more than frothy from investors that don't know what they're doing. I think the frothiness is more on the evaluation side, but I do think it is frothy. And so, you know, we could see, you know, on the other side of the ball where when we always think about things being so cyclical, you know, there's a high cycle, there's a low cycle. You know, in a low cycle, you know, I think what's probably most first to get impacted is on the valuation side. And so the question becomes, you know, if there's valuation pressure, are there investors that are still in that company that are being able to support it going forward? or will those companies just shut down because they were overvalued and there's no capital for them? I think the shutdown because there's no capital available is almost the bubble question versus the support on companies that they think are strong and they have the capital to support it. That's where it's more frothy. And so I'm definitely in the frothy camp versus the bubble camp, because I do think with all the new funds that we have and all the reserves from the traditional venture folks, there's enough capital to continue to support the companies that they think will be successful. And it's not just a question of there's just no capital out there, even for great ideas that people think could be successful. Frothy, but you know, again, yeah, we're in a really strong environment right now.
Well, that's good. And I think if they're well capital funded, and then they have a good outcome, then the exit will be good. It's kind of a good, that as long as you keep that cycle going, the soups keep cooking.
That's right. Totally. Totally agree.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So maybe you can go more specific on the health tech and the medical devices space. The health tech definitely raised a boatload of money. There's a lot more money going into tech, health tech, and device actually is not as much, but it's still going really strong as well compared to the prior years. Can you tell us more
about that?
Which one would you want me to chat about first? You pick.
All right, I'll pick. So I'll start with device. That's a little bit more near and dear to my heart because I've been following it maybe a lot longer than I have health tech. Not that health tech hasn't been around as much. I just haven't been as focused on it. So I think, you know, device, I always sort of see that as slow and steady. Whereas you've seen these huge fluctuations in investments and exits on the biopharma side, for example, really high, you know, swinging wild highs and lows. Device has always felt very steady. And I think, you know, the one concern that we've seen in device over the last couple of years has been Series A investment. So Series A investment over the last couple of years have gone down. So for the last 3 years, the number of deals and dollars, well, deals have been pretty stable. Dollars have declined for sort of three straight years. And so it's been a little bit scary because when you think about, you know, how are you going to have your next gen of great device companies if you can't get the Series A deals done? Mm-hmm. And it felt like, you know, there were less investors that were out there excited about Series A deals. And, you know, even the folks that had great ideas had to really, you know, push those companies through whatever means they could to get to a specific stage in which to raise capital. It's been kind of hard on the device side. And so, you know, it was actually nice to see in Q1 of this year, device actually was up significantly. And if I look at, you know, I think there were 66 deals for, I think, $600 million in for the year in 2020. Q1, I think, was about 50% of that activity in both deals and dollars. So just Q1, which is fantastic. So we are seeing more activity. I think it's being led by a lot more device-focused funds that have recently fundraised. And when you think about some of those funds like, you know, Sante and Sonder and Trio, and those folks that are looking to do early stage Series A deals, Shangbei is another one, you know, very focused in the med tech space and being willing to take Series A risk. That's made me feel good that, okay, we're seeing a little bit of a comeback there. But overall, I mean, the sector, you know, continues to perform strong. I think if I think about the indications that are most interesting in terms of investor appetite, you know, cardiovascular continues to be pretty stable. And I think when we see a lot of, you know, a lot of exits, they tend to be, you know, cardiovascular over the last decade. But cardiovascular is strong, but we're seeing a nice uptick in neuro. especially around like neuromodulation type of technologies. And then we're also seeing imaging type of companies. So, you know, companies that actually have some sort of piece of equipment, but a lot of times there's sort of a software component as well on the analysis side. Those companies are getting a lot of investment. And then sort of a new category that's sort of emerged over the last couple of years that I label as sort of non-invasive monitoring, which is really sensor-based equipment that are sort of monitoring vital signs or different things, especially with sort of, you know, when you talk about a lot of home monitoring and sort of virtual care, which we'll talk about on the health tech side. You know, non-invasive monitoring has received a lot of investment, and we're starting to see some great exit activity there as well. Really, most of this non-invasive monitoring investments on the cardiovascular side. So it's folks that have some sort of cardiovascular issue where they're allowed to go home, and then all of a sudden you're able to monitor them, you know, 24/7 with some sort of sensor-based technology that alerts, you know, their doctors to when something might be going wrong. And so I think those are sort of the really interesting areas. I think robotics, again, also very interesting in the device sector, as well as some of this virtual virtual engagement, either being able to remotely look at surgeries that are happening and advising, so you don't necessarily have to be in the room, which can be huge, especially for developing companies that, you know, you all of a sudden it's a lot harder in nowadays to get your reps into the, you know, into the operating room to be able to do that virtually or in some way to be able to guide these physicians, you know, through these, especially if you're talking about clinical trials or you're talking about sort of early adopters to new technologies. That's also a super interesting area. So that's kind of device in a nutshell. I think, you know, overall feeling pretty good. You know, they're not setting the world on fire, but it's slow and steady, and the investment pace has gone sort of up every year overall, and we're seeing a little bit of a better activity in Series A. So that would be my sort of med tech overview. And then, you know, on the health tech side, you know, that really, you know, that area has exploded over the last 2 to 3 years.
Right.
But I think, you know, this year, talking about 2020 as a full year, you know, this last year was really, you know, where virtual care really came into center stage. I think a lot of people have been talking about virtual care for a long time and been trying to push, you know, hospital systems and payers and physicians and patients all to embrace this. But I think it took the pandemic, you know, for all the terrible things that are around the pandemic, there are some good things that happened. And I think it really forced people to embrace virtual care. So, you know, in terms of, you know, being able to, you know, keep your patients at home, engage with your doctor. So that alternative care space, which is kind of how we, virtual care is a part of the alternative care space as we define it, has seen, you know, leaps and bounds in terms of investment increases. And so virtual care really for healthcare or in the health tech sector has been the biggest area. I think provider operations, which is, you know, just trying to find ways to do things better, also gets a lot of support, but also clinical trial enablement. And that sort of bridges over into sort of biopharma and tools a little bit. But helping to get these clinical trials in a way that's easier to manage or easier to enroll or easier to facilitate, that also has had a lot of investment. So those are probably the three biggest sections. I do think it's pretty interesting when I look at, you know, Q1 of 2021, health tech was kind of a, you know, if I look at Q1, the two sectors that had the biggest increases over their record historical records were biopharma and health tech. And so health tech had huge amount of investments. What's interesting to me is you're seeing a lot of these late stage dollars going in to support these companies that are really on pretty amazing growth trajectories. When I looked at it overall, I think there were 13 financings just in Q1 where the post-money value of these private financings were $1 billion or bigger. So just 13, just in the first quarter of this year. So you're seeing some of these really high growth health tech companies getting slugs of cash at very high valuations. And so, I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunity, but there is some warning bells there too. Mm-hmm. You know, are we overhyping valuation for these companies? Where are the exits that sort of, you know, complement all these investments? And that's sort of where, you know, health tech is not quite meeting the promise that we see in biopharma. Like in biopharma, you're seeing, you know, these huge financing rounds, mm-hmm. but you also saw 84 IPOs last year. Whereas health tech, I think there were...
the Livongo last year.
I think there were 10.
Yeah.
You know, 10 IPOs. And so there's a big difference in terms of the exit environment. And as we mentioned before, you know, I think, you know, you are seeing some SPACs, you know, a lot of SPAC activity, which are these special purpose, you know, acquisition, you know, corporations that are forming and looking for assets. And there's a lot of folks that are focused in health tech. And I think there's a lot of conversations with these companies that are private and have pretty high valuations about going into a SPAC, which then just gets them to be, you know, it basically, they call it de-SPACing into that company being traded on the public market. I think we're going to see a bunch of those. I don't know if it's quite meeting the demand of the companies that are still private at these high valuations, whereas you kind of see IPOs meeting the demand of investment in the biopharma side. It's not quite mm-hmm. at that level yet, but there are some really, you know, positive momentum things there. The question is whether these SPACs that are happening, what type of values are those companies going to go at, and can they hold on to those values in the public market? Because I think overall, you know, that's one of the things that's been really intriguing about the device sector. Even though there's not a lot of IPOs there, the actual performance post IPO for device companies has been amazing, really, really good. I think the median performance is close to 100% over the last 2 years for the device companies. The average performance is about 150%. So they go IPO and then they go up 150%, which is, you know, amazing. We're not seeing that as much on the health tech side. And so far, you know, we've only had a couple of these SPACs on the health tech side be consummated. But those companies are trading down a little bit. So we'll see where that goes. But there's a lot of promise there. There's certainly a lot of capital. And I think what's interesting in health tech from the investor standpoint is that you have healthcare-focused investors that are interested, and you also have tech-focused investors that are interested. And so how they operate together is going to be very interesting over the next few years, because I do feel like, you know, there's a little bit of a difference between valuations, if I just kind of look anecdotally, between, you know, companies that are valued by traditional healthcare investors in health tech versus companies that are valued by traditional tech investors in health tech. It seems like the tech investor companies tend to have higher valuations. And you know, every company is different. So it's hard to know whether, you know, there's just a valuation inflection just because tech investors are used to having different valuations or not. Mm-hmm. But I think it's something to watch. And yeah. I think it's something for companies to be thinking about as they contemplate their next financing is, who do I want? Who do I want on my board? You know, valuation being, you know, take valuation off the table. Who do I want on my board? What can they help me achieve that I need help with or provide that I don't have access to? And then go from there. I do see, you know, what I love seeing, you know, frankly, from my perspective, and this is, you know, whether these companies are successful or not is still to be determined. But when you have folks from both sides on a board, if you have the tech investors that really understand the underlying algorithm or whatever the underlying technology is, you have the health tech investor that's also on the board that really understands the implementation and sales cycle and interaction with, you know, your end user. You know, having those things together, I think, you know, gives these companies the best opportunity to be successful. But both sectors, device and health tech, are doing very well. And it's great to see, you know, the activity and the exits that we're seeing there. And it doesn't look like any of that is slowing down.
Yeah. Do you think, the nice thing with bringing the technology investor that bring a lot more capital, and there seems to be more optimistic about the space compared to the healthcare investor, how much that contribute to all this frothiness in the health tech space?
It's so interesting, and I think, you know, there are a lot of tech investors that have experience in healthcare, but are just at tech funds. So I don't want any of my comments to feel like they're being sort of cast pejoratively at all. But I do think there are also folks that are really in there just for the momentum game and maybe don't understand the healthcare sector as much as, you know, obviously your focused healthcare investors do. But they say, I like this technology. I like how it's being applied. You know, if it works, of course, this is going to be a huge market. So let's go for it. And I think, you know, it's just a different sales cycle and it's a different implementation process in healthcare than it is in consumer or in you know, in your typical business. The regulatory part of it, you know, how fast or slow these actors play, all these things are slightly different. And so I think those are all factors. But I do think, without having folks who understand the next generation of underlying sort of technology, especially on the software side for health tech, you're never going to push things forward if you don't have that expertise. So right. It's a vital part of the problem that's out there. But the other part that's just as vital is the implementation and actually how you actually grow your business and how all those pieces fit together into equaling, you know, sales and revenue ramp. Those are important factors as well. So you need both. I think, you know, there is, you know, tourist dollars across all sectors in healthcare because it has been, you know, so exciting. And, you know, nobody wants to miss out. Right. But you know, you have to temper that. And I think there's room for that on the valuation side, especially, you know, when you're talking about Series B or Series C or Series D, you know, bringing that opportunistic capital that is willing to finance at a high valuation when you already have, you know, your existing investors that are helping to advise the company and making sure they're following the right steps. What I worry about is folks who don't have any experience getting in on the early stage side. And then all of a sudden you don't necessarily have the type of advice and the type of reps and experience that can really be helpful to an early stage company.
Right. Especially when you see all this frothiness that there's so much of the health tech is being funded. As you mentioned earlier, you see a lot of the later stage funded by the big investors. And that means there's a lot more startups, a lot more entrepreneurs want to play in that space. And who is funding those early stage startups? Because I think when this early stage startup, if they don't reap the benefit, then everybody would leave. That would be pretty scary too.
That's right. And so there has to be a balance there. And I think, you know, I do think that's actually one of the reasons that health tech has been so strong is that, you know, tech folks are willing to make those bets, I feel like, a little bit earlier than health tech or healthcare focused investors. Mm-hmm. And so without them, I think, you know, actually we wouldn't be experiencing the growth we're experiencing right now. So I think there's room for all of that. I just think, you know, on the investor side, you know, if you are an exciting company, and, you know, make sure you're affiliating yourselves with investors that, you know, have a stable fund, you know, have a track record, hopefully. And if they have a fund that they've raised that's earmarked for that area, you know, that's a 6 to 8 year, 10 year commitment, right? So that's good. Versus right. The folks that come in and out based on fluctuations within the market. And you just have to be careful. Like, I feel like those are much better fits for later stage rather than early stage.
Yeah. Talking about commitment, NeuroPace went public IPO. Was it last week or is it 2 weeks ago?
I think it was last week. Yeah.
20 plus years.
Yes. And I think they're doing, if I remember right, I was just trying to look at their performance post IPO. And it looks like, at least as of the recording of this, which is on the 26th, they're up about 50% from their IPO right. price, which is fantastic. That's great to see.
Yeah. It's been a while since we see IPO on the devices side.
And I think that's great. And I think there's a nice grouping of companies that have been around for a while that are now getting into revenue and getting into revenue ramp that are going to be great IPO candidates. And I think what's really intriguing to me is if you've seen this great performance in 2018, the class of 2018 device IPOs, the class of 2019, and in the class of 2020, you saw a number of these companies go out and perform really well. Yet, you know, versus biopharma, where, you know, none of these companies have an approved drug or revenue. It's all development. You know, these device companies are almost right. all commercial that are ramping revenue. And when you think about, like, that's the hardest thing to do is to, you know, go public right. and then expect to hit revenue numbers on a quarterly basis, especially in a pandemic. And to see the fact that these mm-hmm. companies have held on to their value and continue to perform has really been amazing. And has been a testament to the quality of companies that have been able to go out, go public on the device realm. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been able to hold on to the value because they're hitting their numbers, and they're hitting their numbers because, you know, people want what they're selling. And even in a mm-hmm. scenario where, you know, maybe procedure volumes are down or elective surgeries are down and people don't want to go to the hospital, they're still finding ways to drive revenue. And that's really been very satisfying, especially for someone, you know, myself. I kind of got into the business in 1999, really focused on a lot of device companies, like, you know, working with, mm-hmm. you know, the Fogarty, you know, spin outs and Simpson and the Foundry and, you know, all these early stage device mm-hmm. companies. And just to see, you know, some of those are the ones that are just, you know, that are really, you know, getting out into the public market now, the ones that are sort of, you know, been around for a while. It's really, you know, satisfying to see because the people that are focused on those companies and the investors have been around for a long time and put a lot of work into creating these companies, and to see the success has been very, you know, very gratifying.
They definitely are patient and very passionate about solving this problem. It's interesting because I think we talked before this podcast about how oftentimes biopharma is rewarded financially huge compared to device. And then you see from what your comment that the device produce revenue and not just development stage.
That's right. And it's a totally different world. And it's almost unfair to compare, you know, biopharma to device. There's a lot more dollars that go into biopharma. But, you know, it also comes down to, you know, when the acquirers strike in each of those sectors. You know, biopharma, like big biopharma, needs to restock their pipeline, and their underlying investors, your shareholders, they, you know, that's what they want. And so you see all these early stage acquisitions for companies that are preclinical, you know, getting into the pipeline because they're, you know, this is predicting, you know, 7 to 10 years down the road, this could be a really interesting drug. Whereas the device mm-hmm. side, it just, you know, it feels like EPS is a lot more top of mind for those players. And so having to invest in money into an emerging technology and then have to acquire them and put more money in to get those companies into, you know, get through FDA approval and into revenue, it just hasn't quite happened the same way that we've seen it happen in biopharma. You do see, you know, some of these companies that get acquired before FDA approval, typically the ones that are focused on PMA, like brand new, you know, innovative devices, and typically they're in big markets. But, you know, the 510K sort of pathway companies, they tend to have to get FDA approval and ramp revenue in order to get to a point where they can right. think about acquisition or public offering. So it's been interesting. It's just a different world, but it's a world that's kind of worked. I mean, again, mm-hmm. you know, you don't see the huge variances that you see in some of the other sectors, but device, you know, just continues to be slow and steady. You know, I think, you know, in the late 2000s, 2008 to 2010, I think there were some real questions as to, you know, how viability, you know, for the device sector and where are things going to go from here. But, you know, over the last 5 to 7 years, you know, looking at the data as we're putting these reports out year over year, you know, it's slow and steady. And you can see, you know, it's been up and to the right, especially on the exits and the IPO side, without, you know, this huge ballooning increase in investments that we saw in biopharma. Yeah, you're seeing an uptick in device exits and you're seeing an uptick in device investment. And it feels like, you know, there's less froth and there's less opportunity for there to be a bubble. Mm-hmm. So I do think device just, you know, it keeps rolling along. You have to be patient. But, you know, folks are getting rewarded now.
Yeah. That's good. It's always good when you see hard work being rewarded. Do you think the industry, the large company, are also thinking about alternative care in addition to their device? Like you see Medtronic and Boston Scientific expanding that space.
I mean, if you think about sort of you know, the idea of, you know, non-invasive monitoring. On the device side,
right.
You certainly have seen, you know, that with device, where you saw Preventice that just got acquired this year, and that was, you know, I think that was Boston Scientific who acquired them, and that was a very big deal. I think it was $1 billion overall, but yeah, it was Boston Scientific. And so, you know, non-invasive monitoring and sort of leveraging that as alternative care is a big deal. And I do think you're seeing your traditional device folks understanding that connected devices is a huge opportunity, you know, not only in the non-invasive monitoring side, but also in the neurology side as well. Where, you know, you have, you know, neuromodulation, neurostim, you know, connected devices that you can dial it in, dial it back. You can, you know, respond and you can communicate with your physician. I think all of that is next gen, and it's not next gen that people are saying, okay, that's going to happen down the road. It's happening now and people are embracing it. And you're finding that, you know, corporates are getting involved on the investment side now into those areas, and now it's sort of turning into exits as well. So, I think that is an important part in the understanding that all these things are interconnected, and that, you know, there's a lot of companies now that you could put into two or three different categories within healthcare or tech, because, you know, it's all about, you know, doing what you need to do, but communicating and responding, and it's sort of a comprehensive product versus a specific product, and you know, specific is good, but when you can be comprehensive and you can actually get data that can help you show how valuable your product is, that's even more important, right?
Right. Yeah. No. So do you think that, in terms of the non-invasive monitoring, do you see also frothiness compared to the regular devices? Because it's kind of have that tech side as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are seeing a little bit of push on the valuation side there, but not, I would say, you know, not necessarily as frothy as we maybe see in biopharma, and maybe not quite as frothy as we see in health tech. I would say it's tempered a little bit, because in the end, it's you still have a medical device itself, and so because it's medical grade data and it's in it, and you also have a piece of equipment, I just feel like you're not necessarily seeing as many of the folks that don't have the experience set in that area getting as involved on the investor side. And so when you don't have as much of those folks, the valuation doesn't get pushed quite as strongly. But I do think people see these opportunities as really big markets. And so I don't think there's any fear about putting in a lot of capital. So I think the one thing you're seeing on the non-invasive mm-hmm. monitoring side is that some of these round sizes are really big. And you're seeing, you know, 50, 100, $150 million rounds. And I think that that is something that, you know, if you look across the different indications within device, you're going to see more of the bigger deals going into non-invasive monitoring and even potentially on the imaging side, because those kind of cross over with tech. And I think the application and the ability of new investors coming with a lot of capital to try and drive and really push revenues feels like there's more opportunity, there's more interest on that side. And it doesn't mean that that's any less important mm-hmm. than your traditional, you know, orthopedic device or your cardiovascular, you know, mitral valve, you know, replacement or, you know, those deals are still very strong, but there's just a very specific mm-hmm. subset of investors that want to invest in that area. And so because of that, the power sort of goes to the investors to determine valuation and capital in, whereas these bigger opportunities get a lot wider array of investors that are interested. And then all of a sudden, you know, the power kind of goes to the company. And the company can engage with a lot of different mm-hmm. types of investors and kind of push valuation. And so that's kind of right. Where I think you are seeing a little bit of that.
Yeah. I know we are way over our time because I can talk to you for another hours easily. But before...
It's super fun. I love it.
We end it. I know. Maybe you can give us your thought, what's going to look like in the next year or two in terms of investment in the space. I think you mentioned about that, but for like the startups, what are the things that can help them get funded?
Yeah, great question. And I think, you know, I do feel pretty good about where we are in 2021. And I think, you know, obviously there's a lot of capital out there. I think the struggle is that you know, finding that first investor as an entrepreneur is just so difficult. Finding that first institutional investor, and you just have to really, you just have to push hard. And I think, yeah, what's interesting is now I think more than ever we're seeing this proliferation of accelerator incubators that are out there that can be super helpful. And obviously, you have to balance what sort of ownership you might be willing to give to those folks for the help that you need to engage. But it does feel like a lot of those companies, you know, are providing a great service for early stage entrepreneurs who might not really understand how the investment cycle works and might not have great connections. You know, the serial entrepreneurs that go and find a new thing, they typically don't have trouble getting funded after their first success. But it's really the folks who have that great idea but don't have the experience or the reps that have the biggest trouble. So the accelerator incubator opportunity can be super helpful. I don't think you look at it as a pass to 100%. Yeah, you're going to get funded after that. But it can really help you with the resources and the thought process of how to make sure that your company is being positioned in a good way. But I do think, you know, we also are seeing that, you know, in the end, what one thing that I think is great for early stage companies is that venture investors themselves are constantly having to have some sort of secret sauce. When you think about the venture funds themselves, they have to raise money from what we say they call limited partners. Limited partners are the folks that fund the venture funds themselves. And the venture funds have to convince these limited partners that what they're doing is going to be valuable and they're going to give them a great return. And a lot of times what's happened is a lot of these venture firms all look very similar because they're all syndicating with each other. So they all have to figure out what is their secret sauce that makes them the right place for the LPs to put their money. And what we've seen over time is that it's all sort of starting to come to this early stage seed strategy. And like, okay, we are going to find companies that we really like. And instead of syndicating and doing a big Series A, we're going to do smaller seed rounds where we're the only investor. We're going to help get this company ready for the Series A so that then when they do raise their Series A, we already have a good percentage ownership. And then we can participate in the Series A and we can dictate the syndicate around it. And so you're seeing that. You're seeing that in biopharma. Mm-hmm. You're seeing that in DX tools. You're also seeing that in device as well. And so, and in health tech. And I think that's really an intriguing thing. So, you know, it used to be, a $500 million firm, there's no reason to talk to them if you're only raising $2 million, right? Because it's not a big enough investment for them. I think that's changed a little bit. And I think it is that you know, these bigger funds, even though it's not necessarily, you know, the time allocation of money, the best investment, but it is in terms of making sure that they're getting involved with these companies at a really early stage. And it helps, you know, their thesis in how they're deploying their capital and how LPs are investing in them. So, yeah, we are seeing a lot more of these bigger funds looking to do smaller deals. And so I think that's great for entrepreneurs out there. And I think that, you know, don't sort of write off a firm as being too big. You know, if you can find ways to get connected to that firm and tell your story, you'd be surprised to learn how many smaller deals are being done. A lot of them don't even hit PitchBook because they're small little stealth deals, but they're being done. I know because I'm interacting with these venture folks on a daily basis, and it helps them distinguish themselves from the other competitor collaborator investors out there that they work with.
And they want to be the one who bring the deals to the syndicate.
That's right. Bringing the deals in equal power, because then you can set up the syndicate that you want. But then you bring in those syndicate members, and basically, because you're bringing them in, you're going to get access to their early stage deals. So it's a win-win for the venture funds. And I think it's going to be a win-win for the early stage entrepreneurs too, because, you know, a lot of these deals are not the ones that have the big serial entrepreneurs behind them, because those are the ones that just raise a really big Series A right out of the bat. These are more the entrepreneurs. You know, the venture investors are investing in these entrepreneurs as next generation entrepreneurs, giving them enough capital to get to a valuation inflection point. And then if they can achieve it, then that unlocks the bigger financing down the road. I think that's a really, you know, important part for the ecosystem to continue to develop. So I'm really glad to see a lot more of that activity.
Well, that's great. And I think you mentioned about having an accelerator, incubator. I never call the Rosemont Institute as incubator accelerator, but we do provide a lot of support to a lot of the early stage entrepreneurs and company. And one thing that we, you know, you mentioned how much you want to, willing to give up. We don't take any equity. So that's one of the advantage, I guess.
That's the best of both worlds.
Right.
Where it, you know, great people who can help your company in a significant way, and sort of providing that opportunity without in a non-dilutive way. That's about as good as you can get.
Yeah. So now, and we always want to work with great people. So I think that's one of our, I always tell people it's all about the people. So anyhow, well, thank you so much for sharing your insight and all your hard work in understanding what's going on in the funding world in the healthcare space.
Absolutely, Christina. It was great to talk with you. I'm happy to come back anytime. Look forward to, maybe you can make it a continuing discussion where, you know, every 6 months or so we can talk about what we're seeing in the market.
That sounds good.
But yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.